Chapter 21, It's Greek to Me by Willie Snow Etheridge. 21, Behind the Iron Curtain by Jeep. The morning the commission was to leave Salonika, the roommate and I were waked at dawn by a terrific racket in front of the Ritz Hotel. Immediately I got up and hung out of the window. About 15 cars were being loaded with baggage and people. They were the cars the Greek government had gathered together in which to send about 40 members of the commission as far as the Bulgarian border, where Bulgarian cars would meet them and take them on to Sofia. With the shouts of the Greek drivers, the porters of the hotels, and the members of the commission, there was bedlam. Some delegates had already left by train, and some, including the roommate, were to fly. The plane assigned to the United States delegation was to make two trips to take those who didn't go by car or train. I was going in an army jeep with Harding Bancroft and Norbert Anschutz. The jeep belonged to the United States military mission in Sofia and had come to Salonika to bring Colonel Gratian Yatshevich for conference with the commission. A smart man, the colonel said, he would go back by plane if Harding and Norbert would like to see the country by jeep. They agreed. The roommate was particularly anxious for Norbert to slow up for a while. He had been constantly on trips of investigation to the Greek islands and into the mountains and had been attacked by innumerable germs. Though a jeep trip would not be easy, it would be, the roommate hoped, relaxing. At my insistence, they said I could go along. We got off about 2 hours after the main caravan. A goodly portion of the population of Salonika was in front of the Ritz to see us start. The jeep had no top, no sides, and very little engine. The radiator was a sieve, and it was impossible to count on finding water when we needed it in water-scarce Greece. And as it was impossible to count on finding water when we needed it in water-scarce Greece, we had to carry an enormous can of it on the floor of the front seat, and on the back seat, 2 5-gallon cans of gasoline, for, of course, there were no gasoline stations between Salonika and Sofia. With this load, there was little room left for the driver, Sergeant Baker by name, Harding, Norbert, and me, not to mention our luggage and coats. But finally, with the kibitzing, the Greeks offering suggestions, we squeezed in. Norbert and I sat between the cans of gasoline on the back seat, and neither of us could move an arm or stretch a leg without the other moving an arm or stretching a leg too. We would have been Siamese twins if he hadn't been born 14 years after me. An hour or two after leaving Salonika, we came to the Struma River Valley, and all the fruit trees were in bloom. It is a wide valley sloping slowly to the gray rock mountains on the faraway horizon, and I found myself yelling frequently, "Look, how lovely! Golly, isn't that pretty?" Fortunately for my peace of mind, Harding is a most responsive person, and he agreed that everything I thought lovely was lovely, but not Norbert. The most he ever said, "Yes, it is nice." As we neared the Greek-Bulgarian border, Sergeant Baker began saying he was hungry and we ought to stop and have lunch. He said it would take at least an hour to get over the border and he couldn't last that long without food. He had brought K rations for just such an emergency, and he was ready to eat them. Since I must find a grassy spot right on the river bank before stopping, we ate it in the end within sight of the border. It was my first experience with K rations, and I liked them. We not only ate the K rations marked for lunch, but also the breakfast and dinner rations. There was a concoction of pork and egg yolk for breakfast, a tart cheese for lunch, and potted ham for dinner. The only drawback was we had no implements with which to eat, not even a pocket knife among us. After trying our fingers unsuccessfully, we ended up using stale sticks of Wrigley's chewing gum. For an unnecessarily long time, we ate and lolled in the warm sun and then gathered ourselves together and headed for the border. That border was to let us, quote unquote, behind the Iron Curtain. We approached it with considerable awe. The commission had argued over going into Bulgaria for many hours. All the members, except the Russians and Poles, felt they must go to Bulgaria to understand more fully the Macedonian phase of the frontier problem. But they could not go without Bulgaria's permission, and that, of course, was impossible to get without Russia's consent. Bulgaria, at this time, was in theory under the supervision of the Allied Control Commission, consisting of Russia, Great Britain, and the United States, but in actuality it was completely dominated by Russia. How this had come about is, I think, extremely interesting. As early as August 1944, Bulgaria, which was fighting on the side of the Germans, wanted to get out of the war and sent a delegation to Cairo, Egypt, to surrender to the British and United States commands there. But for some reason, I don't understand, although perhaps the War Department of those two countries do, there was a delay. In the meantime, Russia moved fast. On September 5th, while the Bulgarians were still cooling their heels in Cairo, Russia very cleverly declared war on Bulgaria. And 5 days later, when Bulgaria surrendered to her without having fired a shot, the Soviet command took over as completely as General MacArthur took over Japan. Then, to strengthen her position, which naturally she had every reason to consider shaky, since Bulgaria had been brought to her knees solely by British and United States planes, she pulled another fast one. When the terms of the armistice were drawn up and Bulgaria, along with Hungary and Romania, was put under the supervision of the Allied Control Commission, the words Soviet High Command were, in some mysterious fashion, inserted after the words United Control Commission. That meant, so Moscow claimed, that Russia was the real power in those areas. So to enter Bulgaria, the commission had to have an affirmative nod from Russia, and finally they got it. It was no mean achievement, but after all, the commission was an arm of the United Nations, which not even Russia wanted to offend. Passing the Greek side of the border was simple. A very handsome soldier with teeth as wide as the petals of Shasta Daisy smiled at us broadly and waved us on. Right then and there, I wanted to weep over leaving Greece. I did love it so. Then we came to the Bulgarian border. A Bulgar officer, nattily dressed in khaki with trimmings of red and insignia of gold, stepped to the side of the jeep. Norbert held out our passports, but the Bulgar didn't take them. He merely glanced at them and signaled us to go ahead. How amazing, we thought. How amazing and delightful. We had expected to have every word on every passport gone over with a fine-tooth comb, and now this casualness. Sergeant Baker stepped on the gas. On the Bulgarian side of the river, in a grove of trees, there was a long picnic table surrounded by 40 or 50 people. They were the members of the commission who had left Salonika ahead of us. Gaily, we waved at them and bumped on. After we had gone a mile or two, Norbert said, "You know, I don't believe that Bulgar officer meant for us to keep going. I bet he only meant for us to join the other members of the commission at that picnic." This seemed a good joke on the Bulgar to Harding and me, but Norbert continued to worry. When you stop to think of it, the Bulgarians have no records of us at all. They don't know who we are. They have nothing. And they have nothing to show that we have even come into the country. You don't think they are going to allow a situation like that to continue, do you? Harding and I hadn't an idea, but Norbert was full of them, and they were all sobering. We were in serious danger. I began to comprehend. If we weren't immediately pursued and shot, we would certainly be shot at the next town. "Listen, we must turn back," Norbert finally declared so positively that right in the middle of the road we turned, and not a minute too soon either. There on our heels was a long black car with Bulgarian soldiers. Fortunately, they had not yet drawn their guns. One, hanging from the running board, waved us down. He was in a rage, gesturing wildly. He sputtered Bulgarian. Gesturing just as wildly, we sputtered English, but we knew we were in the wrong. Quietly and sheepishly, we drove back to the picnic site. There, all was forgiven. Several distinguished-looking Bulgarians rushed up, kissed my hand, and welcomed me, at least I thought they welcomed me, to their country. Then, they piled our plates with more food than pythons could eat, and we were already full to bursting with breakfast, lunch, and dinner K-rations. There were long red peppers pickled in some delicious fashion, caviar, stuffed eggs, blackish salami, reeking with garlic, salmon, ripe olives, chicken fried in thick batter, potatoes, three or four kinds of cake, wine and coffee. Only my years of practice at eating helped me through that meal. As we left the border, the road was terribly ruddy and dusty. It looked as if there hadn't been any rain since the time of man. The valley grew narrower, the mountains more rugged. There weren't many fields under cultivation, but flocks of sheep grazed in all the niches on the slopes. It was pretty desolate country, desolate and backward, except for a surprisingly fine, up-to-date railroad bed that ran along the valley for many miles. Handsome stucco stations, painted bright pink with no visible villages near them, set at regular intervals along the track. Having heard for weeks the Greeks' allegation that Bulgaria and Yugoslavia were planning to join Greek Macedonia with Bulgarian and Yugoslavian Macedonia and form an independent state of Macedonia within the Balkan Federation, we felt fairly certain that the road had been built for a day not yet dawned. Salonika, the capital of Greek Macedonia, was no doubt its intended terminus. Our ride through the villages and towns that afternoon was as exciting as a 4th of July parade, at least to us. People lined the sidewalks to wave, to cheer, and even in some places to throw jonquils. Harding and I loved it. He waved with wide sweeps of his arm and bowed and smiled and said he felt just like General Eisenhower. I decided I felt like Mrs. Roosevelt. I had always wanted to feel like her, and I knew I'd never have a better chance. Norbert waved, too, but brief, stiff waves, and for an hour of these, he announced he felt like Hitler. And after an hour of these, he announced he felt like Hitler. Many of the people were dressed in their native costumes, those heavily woven, stiff, brightly colored skirts and gay blouses and jackets. Some of them had soft goatskin shoes on their feet, and others were barefoot, and all of them were spinning their wool into thread. No matter what else they were doing, hauling water from the well, tending the sheep in the field, nursing the children, or just sitting in the doorways of their small stucco houses, they were always holding distaffs heaped with wool and forever twisting it finer and finer into spindles. End of chapter 21.